It is hard to imagine how busy today's quiet bay was in the 1770s. A historian writes, Edenton's waterfront was lined with wharves and warehouses, and the storefronts were operated by a surprisingly cosmopolitan lot of merchants. The Swiss Boritz, the German Koch, the Frenchman Peyrinot, the Scot Littlejohn, the Irishman Bennett, and many others. On the east side of town, at the point where Pembroke Creek meets Edenton Bay, Joseph Hughes, one of Edenton's foremost maritime merchants, operated a large shipyard capable of producing sloops of up to 200 tons. The largest wharf ran straight ahead of you into the bay, and there were four finger wharves spaced off to the right. The bottom remains lined with ballast stones, used to stabilize ships without full cargoes and dumped overboard as they were loaded. The shipping numbers bring the place alive. In the first half of the 1770s alone, 827 ships cleared port, carrying a multitude of cargo amounting to some 10 million staves, wood strips for barrels, 16 million shingles, 320,000 bushels of corn, 100,000 barrels of tar, 24,000 barrels of fish, 6,000 hogsheads of tobacco, and a great variety of other produce. The same ships brought cargoes of trade goods to Edenton, principally rum, 250,000 gallons, molasses, 100,000 gallons, sugar, 600,000 pounds, salt, 150,000 pounds, linen, 400,000 yards, along with silver tableware, brass candlesticks, Chippendale furniture, and books and magazines. Perhaps among those numbers are 2,100 bushels of corn, 22 barrels of flour, and 17 barrels of pork collected from nearby counties and sent to Boston in September 1775. The shipment was arranged by the Committee of Safety in response to the coercive acts. Despite the Cornwallis rumor, no military action took place on land in the Edenton area during the war. There were, however, two naval incidents. In 1781, a large British row galley had been attacking Patriot boats in the Chowan River, which passes the right side of town as you face the river. It runs aground here in the harbor in June. Local militia row out to it and capture the crew. Then someone realizes the captain is a traitor. Captain Michael Quinn served in the Continental Army from 1776 to 78, but switched sides, perhaps angered when he was called up again by the Patriot government. He is held in the local jail initially, and later marched off to then-prosperous Williamston, North Carolina. While in custody there, Quinn was murdered by his guards on orders from their colonel. They were never charged, and the governor pardoned the colonel. 6 months after Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown, Virginia, a group of Loyalist merchants decide it would be okay for them to resume their old business activities. They arrive on a ship from Charleston and drop anchor in the harbor on Friday, February 25, 1782. On board is a cargo worth 80,000 pounds, roughly $14.5 million today. They were wrong. A Patriot privateer, a state-sanctioned pirate, immediately seizes the Tory ship. Look at the artillery. These cannons were imported for the Revolutionary War, but never used. They were part of a large shipment of artillery arranged in Paris with the Spanish in 1777 by diplomats including Benjamin Franklin. In July 1778, you see a large ship pull into the harbor. The Swiss captain was supposed to land further north by contract, but came here to avoid the British Navy. His ship remains for weeks, perhaps months, as the captain awaits payment. Finally, 22 cannons are purchased by Virginia and removed from the ship by rowboats to the wharf. North Carolina ordered most of the rest, some to resupply Fort Johnston in today's Southport, which had been stripped by the British early in the war. But the state could not pay for all of them immediately. One day, you see the captain dumping several over the side into the harbor, including these before you. He then sails away. The cannons were recovered from the bottom after 1785. They were mounted here in 1861 as a Confederate defensive battery during the Civil War, only to be manually disabled by a United States gunship crew the next year. Look to the left corner of the bay, where a small bridge arcs over Pembroke Creek before it empties just past Queen Anne's Park. Now hidden within a gated community is the home and grave of Samuel Johnston. He owned all of the land along the left edge of the bay, one of his three plantations. Born in Scotland in 1733, Johnston was brought to North Carolina as a toddler when his father got a colonial post through his brother, the royal governor. A Yale dropout, Johnston studied law with local attorney Thomas Barker, Penelope's husband, and passed the bar in 1756. 3 years later, he was elected to the Provincial Assembly and served until that body collapsed with the flight of the royal governor from New Bern in 1775. A strong supporter of the Revolution and member of the Committee of Safety, Johnston nonetheless took in the Pollocks after Cullen's torture and was known to oppose personal violence against Loyalists. Early in the war, he served in the initial provincial congresses, predecessors of the modern General Assembly, facilitating the last two as president. Later, he was in the Continental Congress, but turned down the first presidency of the United States under the Articles of the Confederation that preceded the Constitution. He returned home. After the war, he was a lawyer, president of the state conventions to ratify the U.S. Constitution, governor for two terms, a U.S. senator, and a judge before retiring at age 70. He lived at the house here, Hayes, until dying at 83. Use the walking instructions under Homes of Rebellion and then click its audio clip.